Oh, hello. It's Radio Free Nintendo, and today is June 30th, 2016. I'm James Jones. I'm joined here today, Mr. John Lindemann.
On this last day of June, professionalism is the word of the day.
Is it, John?
It is.
Are we getting paid?
No.
Fuck professionalism, then! Let's do this! Hey, Greg Leahy!
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone. So it was with the intro there, by the way. It was like, oh, you've caught me recording a podcast.
Oh, I didn't see you there.
I've been doing this for almost a year now, the intro, and sometimes I feel inspired.
Okay.
And sometimes I don't, and that was this episode where I was just like, oh, let's try to be... John's plea for professionalism had moved me into a place where I forgot I was doing a podcast. That'll be edited by our esteemed Mr. Guillaume Vayette.
I tend to inspire.
I am next to a roaring fireplace wearing a sweater.
In the summer.
And drinking something classy. I don't know what, but yes.
Cavassier.
Yes.
There we go. Sure. In summer. But we are also joined this evening. I had to think about what time of day it is. This isn't going well. By our friend of the show, Mr. Ed McNulty.
Hey, this is my second... Nintendo World Report podcast appearance within a week.
I gotta talk to somebody.
This is probably a
red flag somewhere.
Yeah, it's an oversight.
You actually were on connectivity. I don't know who's gonna get out first.
I think connectivity is.
Okay. To talk about Zero Time Dilemma, correct?
To bitch about Zero Time Dilemma, yes.
A game you like.
A game I really like.
A game you're speedrunning right now, actually.
A game that I currently have the world record speedrunning. I beat that game from start to end credits in 18 minutes this morning.
There's a call for help somewhere happening here, and I'm not sure who's responsible for it. But you were on with Donald to talk about, in part, the experience of reviewing a game like that when there's nothing to go on, and... some of the issues that game has in and of itself.
A lot of it is the issues that game has in and of itself. Mm. That is a spoiler cast that you should not listen to until you finish the entire Zero Escape trilogy. But man, that game has some plot holes. That game has a bad ending.
That's a shame. Well, I mean, it has a lot of bad endings, but it has an ending that is also poor.
The true ending is of low quality.
There we go. So we're not going to talk about that game today too much. I don't have it yet. I'll probably get on it.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give myself some time on it. But I love that series, so we'll get to it. But, Greg?
Yes?
What have you been playing?
I probably should wrap up on Kirby Planet Robobot, so I'll do that. I've found everything now, so I feel pretty qualified to talk about it. Definitely enjoyed the back half of the game. They did ramp up a little bit in terms of some of the stuff being harder to find. Although I'd say the cubes that you collect to unlock like the special levels and stuff like that are probably even easier to find or sort of more explicit than they were in Triple Deluxe when they were the Sunstones or whatever. They seem to be a bit more upfront about them in certain cases. Like, say, for instance, you'll be in a series of sort of paths where they kind of fork off and all that, and one of them will lead to a chest that contains one of these cubes. Then in this case, they tend to have very sort of explicit like signage that will like at least give you clues as to, okay, take this route, then that route, then that route, and you'll get there. Rather than, I think there was some trial and error in the past. Maybe it was in the Wii game. I forget now. They kind of run together a little bit. But, you know, they seem to have made those a bit more upfront, and the stuff that's really well hidden now is the golden stickers in this. That would be kind of, I guess, like you had special keychains in Triple Deluxe. This time you have stickers, sort of decals you can put on the arms of the mech when you're controlling that. And some of them you just collect a sticker icon and then it'll randomly give you one. But then there's a subset that you can only get from specific levels in specific locations. These golden ones, the rarest ones that have sort of... They tend to sort of save some of the most special designs for that, like the HAL logo and stuff like that. Mm. But some of those are incredibly well hidden. Absolutely, yeah, I mean, the really, really obscure stuff. But I enjoy tracking it all down, and then having, you know, beating the game, the finale is impressive in scale, as it's kind of a tradition with Kirby. I remember when I played Kirby's Adventure on NES for the first time, I was impressed with how big it seemed, the finale.
Yes.
Even though I was playing it in, you know, 2013 or whatever, it was like, oh, wow, this is, you know, and they do tend to try and live up to that, you know, with this run of, you know, sort of most recent Kirby side-scrolling games. And this is up there with the big finale, so that was good. And then that leads on to the Meta Knight speedrun kind of mode, Meta Nightmare Returns, which in Triple Deluxe, it was DDD that had the speedrun mode, which seems like an odd choice, doesn't it? You know, the big, heavy character for that. But it was kind of interesting what they did with it, because, like, there's, as talked about with Kirby, there's a number of sort of puzzle-solving elements in it these days. And in that game, what they did is they cut out a number of sections of levels to make the speedrun sort of more palatable. And those are generally the hypernova bits. But you could kind of cut bits out yourself. If you went sort of off the beaten track and went into a puzzle room and kind of solved it, it would warp you ahead. You know, so you could kind of find ways that actually doing that would cut really significant bits off your time. And it was quite an interesting way to replay the game. Meta Nightmare Returns in this, in Robobot, is more straightforward. You're playing as Meta Knight, who is a speedier character and all that, and you're not dealing with, like, as far as I've seen anyway, I haven't played through it twice, any kind of skips or anything like that by finding things off the beaten track. You are kind of, as all the enemies you defeat kind of fill up an energy meter, which can be used to activate certain powers. And the chief sort of power among that is to make Meta Knight faster. So you kind of, there's a kind of tension there between obviously wanting to get through the level as quickly as possible. It is a speedrun mode. But at the same time, if you don't kill any enemies, you're not going to fill up that bar, to actually make your basic movement faster. So you're trying to sort of manage that as well as you can. And then sometimes it's like, oh, well, this is a fixed scrolling bit, so it's not really much point making Meta Knight faster. It's not going to make the level go faster. So now I'll save my power, and you can sort of save it up for some huge sort of Mega Crush type attack that you can activate on a boss, which will make killing that a lot quicker. So it's not devoid of sort of thought and strategy, but it feels a lot more frantic than DDD, DDD Tour, as it was called, on Triple Deluxe. So it's got a cool way to replay the game. Very brisk. This time it's not quite so cut and dry what kind of gets taken out, because the mech stuff, which replaces the hypernova things from Triple Deluxe, is a bit more weaved into the game, you know, the levels more, you know what I mean? It's not as separate as it was before. You know, there are parts of the levels where the mech, you don't necessarily have to even find it. It's hidden somewhere, and you might get it, and that'll enable you to get, you know, an extra cube or a badge or whatever, that kind of stuff. So, you know, and I do actually like that about that. I mean, I think the ultimate kind of thing I came down on was this using the mech and the sort of versatility of that probably is like the best idea they've come up with to kind of give some sort of complement to the traditional Kirby gameplay. It's really quite clever in a way, because it feels very empowering at times, in that you'll get a number of hazards that Kirby would normally have to avoid. You know, for a giant mallet swinging into the screen, and if they hit you, you'll get splatted onto the screen like, you know, Smash Brothers or something. But when you're in the mech, you can just destroy them at will. You know, just completely wreck the level and go through and all this stuff. But the clever thing about it is it's actually thoroughly disempowering, because you can't just float at will anymore. So they can actually do things with environmental puzzles and stuff where it's like, well, yeah, you actually have to, you know, bring a block to build a platform so you can reach this thing and all that. It actually puts limits on you that make them able to do things with level design that you can't always do with Kirby. But at the same time, it doesn't feel like you're being nerfed because you're wrecking everything. It's quite a clever little thing they've done there, a little trick. And I really like what they've done with this game. I think it's be tough to top, I suppose, other than, you know, the multiplayer angle. If they take it back to console, whether it would be NX or whatever else at some point, but, thoroughly recommended for people who enjoy Kirby.
Can I ask you what you think of one of the mini games, which is the kind of the 3D puzzle mode thing?
There's not a lot of it. There's, you know, it's very brief. It's kind of a cute little idea. I got like a platinum score on the first level, and I haven't replayed the other two yet. And it's just kind of main thing is about preserving a combo. Mm-hmm. So you're sort of trying to absorb the enemies and then spit them out and take out enemies, you know, in as fewer shots as possible, kind of thing. You know, and if you absorb multiple enemies at once, then your shot becomes piercing. So it can cut through, you know, a whole line of enemies and kill them all at once. That's one of the big sort of mechanics of it. But there's not a huge amount there. Like I said, that you're kind of, they just get slightly more, there's like three stages to it. They get slightly more, intricate in terms of the kind of patterns and the comboing potential, but, a neat little idea, but it is very much just like a sort of concept piece. And it's not really kind of, explored very thoroughly at this point. I don't know whether they would do a separate eShop version as they did with those equivalents in Triple Deluxe down the line.
Right. Yeah, because they had kind of the DDD rhythm game standalone thing on the eShop and they had a few, the kind of the Smash Brothers.
The fighting, Kirby Fighters, and then they had the deluxe versions on the eShop. So in that case, there was, I mean, here, in addition to the 3D puzzle thing, you've got, the kind of, we pick a class and fight a boss. And you can do it in multiplayer. You know, I've only done that in single player where I kind of picked the, Kirby, the sort of hammer Kirby class where he's just, you know, the brute doing tons of damage, just kind of sticking in there. But you've got, you know, it could be a healer, you can be sort of balanced player, that kind of thing. So it could be fun in multiplayer, but I've yet to try it out, unfortunately. And I don't know what kind of capacity that would have for expansion, but I think that there's more to that mode, at least in terms of how much time you might spend with it, because there's a number of bosses to fight there that's kind of going to take longer than the 3D puzzle game. But it's a good package. Really, really happy with that. So I'll just wrap up quickly for this week. I did sort of follow through on my sort of promised to play Aria of Sorrow, as Gion was talking about, Order of Ecclesia. I bought it this week, and I didn't really intend to kind of burn through it, but I did. I was enjoying it. Yeah, you know, I burned through it just a couple of nights. You know, but I won't go too long. Obviously, we've already talked about this sort of game last week, but you know, my observations of it were, you know, that early on, the bosses are not very sort of carefully designed. They, you know, it's kind of as I thought I remembered it, and I hadn't played through it since the, you know, 2003 or whatever, maybe four. Maybe I replayed it once after that. But you know, as it takes a little while to get cooking on the action front, I think probably by the time you hit death, like, it's probably the first boss that really has a bit of sort of teeth to it. But then, you know, some of the subsequent ones are pretty good and it picks up. But I think that is somewhere where I think they definitely did kind of improve things later on, you know, the DS games and stuff. But what I liked about this was definitely how lean it was. You know, it's one of the Iga Venia games that doesn't really have a lot of copy and paste level stuff going on. You know, doubling the size of your Harmony of Dissonance had the kind of, you know, sort of double castle thing going on, and, you know, sort of stuff like Portrait of Ruin, you know, had kind of two versions of the off, you know, sort of branching off stages and all this kind of stuff. It's something they do a lot. And you don't get that with this. There's a tiny little bit of like going through palette swap chaos world at the very end, but it's very short and kind of pointless, really. But the fact that it's got quite tight experience was what I really liked. It makes it great for replay. So go through it really smooth, and there's the layout of the castle, I think, is really nice. The actual design of the individual rooms still is not stellar. That's what my long-standing issue with those games, but the way it all interconnects and all that is pretty satisfying. There's only a few kind of inconveniences about the way they sort of allocate certain abilities, like kind of dealing with water, to specific souls, which will end up with you switching a lot, which is a little bit irritating. This is something they'll kind of address a little bit later on, where you could have pre-set like loadouts to pick from, of souls or glyphs or whatever the individual game would be, but they hadn't sort of reached that point here. So you do get some fiddliness with that, but it's not anything particularly major. So I do like the way everything interconnects, and they sort of the way they kind of space out the physical sort of upgrades that enable you to go and explore more of the castle. The only thing is, I guess, environmentally, it's a bit kind of routine, a bit run of the mill. It's kind of all the stuff you expect to see from an Igavania sort of castle, in terms of, oh, there's the arena and the entry hall and the clock tower and the castle keep. And it doesn't. The one thing about some of the games where they kind of had these little levels off to the side is that they did do wackier things with the environment. They went to London and the pyramids in Portrait of Ruin, which doesn't really make the levels better, but at least there's a bit of aesthetic variety, if nothing else. But yeah, it's just well worth. I think it's a great. Well, if you're looking to revisit one, it's great because A, it's on Wii U Virtual Console. You can have it digitally and off TV play and all that. But also, it's just so tight, so quick. There's just not a lot of flab on it, and it's actually the requirements for the better ending. While of course you just look it up. Fairly explicit. It's not as like arcane as some of them. So right. Obviously I was working off some knowledge of the game from before, but I just plowed right through it. It was a load of fun.
Cool. Guillaume?
So I haven't played a lot this week, but I did go and download the Seventh Dragon demo, and now I finished the full game.
Guillaume, we have the game.
I know. I just wanted to see if it gave a good idea of what the full game is, and I don't know. I didn't know what to talk about. Shut up.
Okay, fine.
But
do you, man?
Yeah. So I finished a full game, but I wanted to hold off talking about it because it's not out for two weeks still.
Yeah, I think, are we still under review embargo? I think we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's also that, but I also didn't want to be I've got a copy and you don't. It's not even released yet.
We did that a month ago.
Yeah, well, Sega gave me a free copy. Yes. Sonic is real. He's fast, and he's my friend.
Sonic.
Brands aren't your friend, Guillaume.
Look out with Sonic around your girlfriend. We've seen how that goes.
Oh, he has to go fast, you know what I'm saying?
But yes, I can tell people that
professionalism is the word of the day.
Oops. God.
Oops, sorry. Go ahead, Guillaume, yes.
So I would recommend people check out the demo. It is the beginning of the game, and there's surprisingly a good amount of it. You get all the way to the point where you unlock the skills for your characters, the point where you can allocate points to your skills, choose which ones you want to gain and improve, and then the game leads you towards the portal that's going to lead you to the next area of the game, and then thanks for playing the demo. You play it and you get a pretty good impression. I think I saw even people on Twitter being oh, this is so Etrian Odyssey, and I was surprised because they seem to have no knowledge of who started the series, the creators of Etrian Odyssey, and yet it was immediately obvious to them, this is so EO. Completely copied off EO.
It wears on its sleeve a little bit, but
yeah,
it gets even more EO-y as you go in a lot of ways. So
yeah, probably. But as I've said, you know, like I think that the battles are just faster and just more satisfying in many ways than the Etrian Odyssey battles. So yeah, like check out this demo. Some things that might disappoint people, there's no 3D, and
nope.
You know, there's not more 3D in the full game. It's all
it is a 2D game.
Yeah, which is disappointing, because as I've seen some people say, it's also kind of ugly, you know? At least, like, the initial area is, doesn't start on the right foot, because it's all purplish, which is,
yeah.
You know, kind of the worst color. And it's also, it's got all these, like, little, purple flowers all over the place, but they're kind of, I guess, these sprites on in this 3D world. Like, it doesn't come across well. Like, they look low res. The 3DS screen is low res. And when you couple that with a lack of 3D, it's just like there's no kind of eye candy, or there's nothing to kind of smooth over those pixels to make those, those details everywhere a little bit more palatable.
Sounds like you're talking about the 3DS version of Zero Time Dilemma.
I guess we'll get into that later.
Someday. Yeah. The 3D effect of games does kind of round out hard edges because of the averaging effect of the two things and the fact that your eyes are focusing on actually two different images, and some of the hard edges can be kind of softened. This game is a 3D game, but it does not render in multi-dimensional display. Like
not feature stereoscopy.
Correct.
Right.
So those hard edges stand out a lot more. Now,
yeah, they do. And the art style that they chose, I think,
it's I wouldn't call it super deformed. I would call it mostly deformed. Like it's
right, but it doesn't play well with the low resolution. You know, like the game does not look good. But the battle system is the star here, and you do unlock in the full game way more skills than you see in the demo, and. Actually, play through the demo because they give you some items that you can equip to gain more, skill points to allocate. So that, like, it's actually kind of a good thing to start with. Like, it's a good bonus for playing through the demo. And then your levels, your characters are going to carry over to the full game. So you've got nothing to lose.
And you get to create three characters, I guess, at this point in the game.
Actually, no, that's one downside. They don't let you customize the appearance of your characters or name them. So they're already named and they're already kind of created.
The save file carries over, right?
Yes, it does. So I guess you're never going to be able to change these characters. But it doesn't really matter.
I think you can edit them anyway in the full game.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can change their class. For sure.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure if you can change your appearance. Okay. But.
I don't know. But I feel like it's going to be harsh if I don't have to go through the 75 Japanese seiyuu they put in this game to determine whose voice I want to use.
Right. Yeah. So another thing that I played, I learned while doing some research that the awesome music of Seventh Dragon is composed by the same composer as like Streets of Rage. And it kind of makes sense.
Also the same composer that does Etrian Odyssey, so...
And the same composer who does Etrian Odyssey, indeed. Although I played mostly 4, and 4 didn't have the BGM sound. Like, I played it with kind of the orchestral music, so it didn't have like the kind of the groovy beats that you can dance to.
Yuza Kajiro is the master of FM synth, which the Streets of Rage will make you think of that, and so will though when you use that option on Etrian will make you think that as well.
Right, so Seventh Dragon has a lot of kind of like club music or techno music, for lack of a better word. So it's actually catchy. You know, it makes me feel pumped up for to kick some dragon ass. So awesome. But I was looking through this guy's resume, and when I saw that he also composed Super Adventure Island, it was like an epiphany, because Super Adventure Island has this weird soundtrack that's nothing like the other Adventure Island games. And it does sound very much like a Streets of Rage title. So I don't know. Like, I saw that, and I just, like, all of a sudden, I was seeing stars, like, the secrets of the universe were being unlocked. And so, I started playing a little bit Super Adventure Island.
We've gotta go deeper.
Revisiting it, and it's still a fun game. It's funny, because I've got this nostalgia for Hudson Games, but it's a nostalgia that comes from 5 years ago. Because that's when I played these. That's when I played these titles on the Wii Virtual Console. You know, like back in the day on the NES, I did play the first Adventure Island, but it sucked. And it was also part of like it was in one of those pirated cartridges with like 300 different games.
7001.
yeah, something like that. So it was like, okay, so I've played a level and a half of Adventure Island, and this game is an asshole, and I'm gonna switch to something else now. I'm going to play a game of Mario where he can swim in the sky. But,
I would say if it's one of those 7001, you played Super Mario and Super Advi or something along those lines.
Yeah. Yeah, like all sorts of weird hacks of Mario. And yeah, like it was fun times. But,
little did you know you were playing the proto Mario Maker.
But Super Adventure Island is much more, is a much better game. Like the original Adventure Island, I swear it's kind of like one of the original, like I've seen someone refer to these as Mazocore, kind of like the original kind of dickish platformer where yes, everything Mazocore. Is exactly at the spot where your instincts are going to kill you.
Yeah,
you know.
Poorly designed is another word.
Yeah. Yeah, but it seems intentional, you know,
no,
like
no,
it's
designed poorly. Is
Anyway, like it just like that game is terrible, but then I played the Wonder Boy and I played the other kind of sequels to Adventure Island and I don't know. I really like them. Like they gave me kind of that Bit Trip Runner vibe. You know, I guess now, like, I don't know, Infinite Runners have a lot to owe to Adventure Island. It's weird. But anyway, Super Adventure Island, great soundtrack. It's actually possible to beat, unlike the first Adventure Island. It was probably back on the SNES. It was probably seen as a step back, I suppose, because you know, you didn't have the dinosaur buddies. It was back to just Master Higgins with his skateboard and his knee pads and helmet and throwing tomahawks and stuff. But I like that kind of simplicity.
Takes you back to your childhood, doesn't it, Guillaume?
Well, it takes me back to 5 years ago now.
But, well,
just
guess.
You in Quebec with a skateboard and throwing tomahawks.
At dinosaurs.
Oh, yeah.
In your jungle.
Yeah, at candles, sentient candles, and I don't know. There's weird enemies, like when the enemies aren't, yeah, like sentient candles and stuff like that are just walking around in caves.
Like, wait,
they're downright
offensive.
Are these
sentient candles or scented candles?
That's exactly.
No, sentient. But maybe
they're not mutually
sentient,
exclusive.
Actually, maybe that's something that got lost in translation. Maybe you know, the Japanese heard about sentient candles and just like it got twisted and
I was just thinking
the translation.
You were just saying like that, like you were setting the mood. Oh, you know, the scented candles takes me back. I don't know.
But
Romance.
What else is there to say about this game?
Just skateboarding around the Big O, throwing scented candles, sentient candles.
Sure. Anyway, I recommend checking it out. Like, if you like kind of very simple but very fun and well-designed platformers, it's good. And if you're one of those people who thinks that everything is too PC these days, you do shoot your tomahawks at monkeys wearing tribal masks, chucking spears at you. So I think you'll be enjoying this. Yeah.
Takahashi Meiji, no, kill them all.
Worked in the
80s. Well, yeah. You're playing as a mockery of Aboriginal people with the kind of leaf skirt. So yeah, there's something for everyone in this game.
Thanks, Konami.
No, Hudson. Hudson.
Same thing now.
So Guillaume, if you really feel the Takahashi Meiji itch, I'm sure there will be a Takahashi Meiji no Pachinko available for you in the next 6 to 8 months. Where
I was about to say, you know who's going to take advantage of that nostalgia.
That's right. That's what we do. It'll be exercise equipment where you throw tomahawks and pachinko. So
that would be amazing.
Might get me into this gym.
At the same time, John.
All right,
you have a tale of woe worthy of tomahawks and skateboards for us.
Indeed. I have to provide context
for this.
Whatever
the fuck that means.
What the hell was that transition?
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I have to provide some context for this. As I tell this story, I want everybody to bear in mind that
does it involve shoes in a box, John?
No, but it's.
I already win.
It doesn't, but you know, honestly, I could laugh at it if that was the case, while crying. So I want everybody to bear in mind that the point of this was to enable me to play Mylon's Secret Castle. A single game, and that game is Mylon's Secret Castle. Just bear that in mind.
All the games.
So this all started about 2.5 years ago when my 3DS died and I had to send it in for repairs. So I had to send it off, so it was dead. They had to wipe it, and I don't even really know what went wrong with it. It just literally died overnight one day, just wouldn't even boot. So I sent it off for repairs, and so they sent me, because I'm a respected professional journalist.
Jesus.
A member of the press, all right?
Thanks, Johnny Metz.
Yeah, so Neil was able to, you know, pull some strings, as he is wont to do, and get me a temporary 3DS. So I figured, for one of our podcasts, they had just released Mylon's Secret Castle, and so I was like, well, you know, just for a lark, I'm gonna play that game. And so, but I was like, hey, I don't have this isn't my normal hardware. I wonder if I can download this single game to it, because hey, it'll be easy to transfer it to another piece of hardware once I get my real 3DS back, right? So I downloaded it, and I believe if I think back, I probably signed in with my Nintendo ID on that temporary 3DS.
No.
Okay, but I was able to decouple it. I don't remember how, but I was able to decouple it and sign back in on my main 3DS, because up to this point, my main 3DS has been totally fine. So my main 3DS was completely working, no problem. I could download stuff from the eShop, you know. But I always had this backup 3DS just sitting there with a single copy of Mylon's Secret Castle on it. So I was like, all right, finally we're gonna reconcile this, and I want to get Mylon's Secret Castle from this backup 3DS onto my main 3DS. That's it. So this is probably about 2 months ago. I called Nintendo and I said I explained everything, and I said, hey, I just want to get this single game onto my main 3DS. And the guy's like, okay, cool, you know, we'll set it up. And so he puts in their work ticket, and he said, okay, you know, in 3 to 4 days, you'll get an email saying that the work has taken place, and you should be good to go. And I'm like, okay, cool. So, you know.
Pause.
Yeah.
Quick question.
Mm-hmm.
Was Mylon's Secret Castle worth it?
No.
Take that, Johnny Metz.
No,
okay, you can continue. No. You can continue.
Definitely not. Definitely not.
And it never was.
No,
continue.
And you'll, yeah. Even at face value, it was not worth it. And when I tell you what I lost because of it, you'll say definitely no. So, okay. So get off the phone with that's the first contact with support, right? So at this point, so a couple days go by, I get the email, and I, you know, it's not really a priority for me to play Mylon's Secret Castle at any point, right? So I was just like, you know, I'll have a look at, you know, whenever I have a chance, next time I'm playing on my 3DS, I'll see if I can, you know, get that over there, download it or whatever. So a little bit of time goes by. So I pick up my 3DS and I'm like, hey, I might as well, like, you know, just get this out of the way, get this whole thing cleared out, and, you know, download Mylon's Secret Castle to my 3DS. So, I go to log on to the eShop, and it says, the Nintendo ID that you're trying to log in with, is no longer linked to this piece of hardware. Something to that effect. And I'm like, oh man, right there I knew it. I'm just like, I'm in for some shit. Because something they did magically decoupled my Nintendo ID from this piece of hardware. So at that point, I didn't even want to deal with it at that point. I let it sit for a couple of weeks, and then finally, you know, I had some time last weekend, and I was like, okay, we're gonna get this. We're gonna engage the beast here. We're gonna get to the bottom of this. So I called them up and I explained everything, and it was actually pretty. It was pretty hard to actually get through. The first girl that I talked to, it was pretty hard to kind of like get her to understand what was going on, because it didn't make any sense. Because she was like, okay, well, if your Nintendo ID, first off, because she checked my account, and so I had my Wii on my Nintendo ID, I had my Wii U linked to it, and nothing else, which makes no sense. However, it makes sense when she told me that the work ticket that the guy actually put in originally, what that did was instead of saying transfer this game to this this game from serial number A to serial number B, he put in the same serial number on both sides of the transaction. So what that wound up doing, and the girl was like, oh my God, she's just like, this guy put in the same serial number on both sides. And I'm like, oh great. And she's like, yeah, that guy, I don't know what that guy was doing. He doesn't even work at our call center. So I don't know what call center I got when I talked to that guy, but yeah, so that pretty much.
Did you dial the wrong number and some dude just tried to help you?
No, believe me. So at that point,
the support call was coming from inside the house.
Yeah. So at that point, I mean, I wish that would be the case, because then I could just kill the person that did this. They'd be very easy to find. So at that point, I'm pretty much screwed. So I was trying to figure out, and the thing is, I had the second 3DS. I didn't have it. It was packed away in a box that I hadn't even unpacked. So I had to find it, right? And so that call concluded with, well, see if you can find that piece of hardware and give us a call back. And I'm like, okay, that makes sense. So, I did finally find it, call them back. And so, you know, she told me about the second person I talked to. I had to explain the whole thing again, of course, which was awesome. So what I wound up having to do was, so at this point I had my two 3DSs, the temporary one has the coveted Mylon Secret Castle on it, but it's not linked to any Nintendo ID at all. It's completely decoupled from anything, so it's just a game sitting on there randomly. And then I had my my main 3DS with everything on it, but it was decoupled from my Nintendo ID, so I couldn't do anything with either one of these you know 3DSs. So what I had to do first, she said, "Well, what should work?" And she said that they should have told you this in the first place, and they didn't. Is you can do like the app transfer. Between 3DSs, right? So, but that wouldn't even have saved me in the first place, because you actually have to have, well, the guy screwed me. It probably would have helped me in the first place if I never would have called Nintendo support. I probably could have just done that, maybe. But because what the guy did with the two serial number thing that decoupled everything from everything is I had to wipe my main 3DS. So I just had to wipe that guy. So that just wiped everything. So it had no Nintendo ID tied to it. And then I had to link my Nintendo ID to the temporary one, so at least I had like a point A to start from. In other words, my temporary 3DS had my linked Nintendo ID on it, and then from that point on, I had to transfer my Nintendo ID from the backup 3DS, bringing Mylon Secret Castle along with it to my main 3DS.
You brought the Plague Child with you?
Yes. So I transferred my Nintendo ID from the backup. So I put my Nintendo ID on the backup, wiped my main one, transferred it from my Nintendo ID from the backup to the main one, and then downloaded everything again, along with Mylon Secret Castle. So what's the upshot of that? What was the purpose of all this? Well, I got Mylon Secret Castle. So that's awesome. And I can connect to eShop, and that works. But let's see. So, of course, I had to wipe my main 3DS, so that means that I wiped stuff like all of my Street Pass puzzle pieces for the second time, I might add, for the second fucking time. And I lost all of my my VC save files. So my Pokemon Yellow save, gone. See you later.
That's weird, though. Like, we talked about this on Sunday, but like, why are the other saves okay?
I don't know, and you know, I was saying to James when I was completely ranting over text about this, I'm sure there's probably something I could have done to prepare for this better than I did, but the fact that I can even get into this is just absurd. I shouldn't have to go through this much trouble. But the one thing that was intact was my Monster Hunter 4 save file, so that was good, because that would have stung. So
yeah, that'd have been bad.
But yeah, but I mean, there's other stuff too. It's like, you know, downloading themes and like all that kind of stuff. It's all been wiped. So
Well, John, yeah. I have good news for you. Look forward to our next retroactive Mylon's Secret Castle.
Oh, God. I mean, well, that's the thing. Now I'm going to play through it. I started playing it.
Fuck
and I beat the,
you, we're not doing it then.
And I beat the first boss, so...
retroactive cancelled.
Guillaume's already warned you about the sunk cost fallacy, and you're still pulling this shit out.
Yep.
Nope. Now it's my
personal
Moby Dick. That is my long secret castle. I'm Ahab, and it's Moby Dick, and I'm loading up the harpoons, baby. I'm loading them up, and we're hitting the high seas.
How is it that it's Nintendo customer support effing you over that convinced you to play this, and Johnny Metz couldn't?
Well, I mean, I think that's actually a fairly straightforward answer, so I don't think we need to go into it.
So I got to get something out of it, and apparently Mylon's Secret Castle is the booby prize. So, all right, I'll just roll with that. Okay, so but the whole purpose of this really, the reason why I resolved this in
Speaking of hunting animals.
Yes, was to get the Monster Hunter Generations demo. So
all right,
I downloaded
Queequeg,
that.
Tell me about the Monster Hunter Generations demo.
Yeah. So I downloaded that actually just, I got home and kind of rushed to download it and put a little bit of playtime into it before this podcast. So it's Monster Hunter. I mean, what are you going to say, right? It looks exactly like Monster Hunter 4 Ultimate. In terms of the demo itself, it's funny because Capcom seems to just, they kind of like make little improvements every time they make one of these for a Monster Hunter game. And it's like, it's just kind of endearing. It's like, this still kind of sucks, but you know, Capcom just, They try. So the big thing that they've added to this one. I think I've played the demos for. I played the Monster Hunter 3 one, which was terrible. But this one, what was that?
On 3DS.
The Monster Hunter 3 demo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a Wii one, wasn't it?
Try. Try was the Wii one.
Yeah.
Wait,
I'm getting them.
But there was some sort of demo for Wii, wasn't there, under certain circumstances?
Yeah, there was a disc.
There was a demo for 3 on Wii, and then there was a...
Yep.
I don't know if the Wii U and 3DS version of 3 got demos.
I did get the disc version of 3 for Wii. So,
okay.
And that was terrible.
Yes,
so,
it was.
Yeah, but this one is a little bit better because what they do is they really put the map front and center. Like, they show it to you in between as you go from area to area. They show you, they have like these little guide arrows to show you where you should go to follow the monster, because the monsters, of course, you know, you beat them down and then they get tired of fighting you and then they fly off to the next area. So they kind of guide you a little bit more. And they do have tutorials in there, for, I think there's three parts to it. There's like, I have it right here. Let me just open it.
From Hell's Heart, I stab at thee, John.
Yeah, so the tutorials, they have Hunter Basics, Weapon Styles, and Hunter Arts. Hunter Arts are the big thing that they've added, and they're really just super moves. So they're kind of like things that, you know, you can activate them via the touchscreen as you're fighting, and they're, you know, it's like a big swipe, or you evade really quickly or something like that. So I'm still kind of getting used to those. And then, of course, they have the Prowler, which is where you get to play with the felines. And I haven't done that yet, but apparently the point of that is to kind of almost be like a sort of a recon role, where you can hide underground and stuff, just like the felines used to do in previous games. So so the idea is, like, it's just, you know, you can evade monsters really, really easily, and just kind of see, you know, kind of see how they behave, because, you know, one of the big things with Monster Hunter is you'll have to learn how each monster behaves and their signs and their tells, they call them tells, and, you know, when they're weak and all that kind of stuff. So, yep. So, the demo has three monsters: Great Macaw, which is just kind of like a jaggy, sort of a T-Rex kind of thing. The Malfestio, which is an owl monster, and the Narca Kuga, which is he's, you know, a wyvern that's just, you know, he's from previous games. So, yep. So you can pick any one of those: beginner, intermediate, advanced, and then you can choose all the weapons, And yeah, so then it goes into the Hunter Arts, where there's Guild, Striker, Aerial, and Adept. And, you know, Guild and Striker, you both have like two arts and three arts. And that's kind of like, you know, if you want to focus on art heavy gameplay where, you know, you want to do your super moves a lot and stuff like that, that's for those. For Aerial, it's more about, It's more about, you know, jumping on monsters, jumping high into the air, and you can also apparently launch yourself off of other players, which I'd like to see in action. So I think it's ideal for probably fighting really, really big monsters where you have to, like, you know, where, you know, it's, you know, you have to jump on top of them and, like, take them out. Like, I'm sure some monsters probably have, like, something on the top of their head that you have to crawl up and hit or something like that. Or usually it's doing extra stuff like that gains you extra, like, monster pieces, you know, the kind of rare items that you use to craft stuff. So I'm sure that's what it's used for. And then there's the adept style, which is, you know, evading and doing counterattacks. So those are kind of your four styles. So, you know, those are kind of, they're subtle changes to the gameplay, but it's kind of more, you know, iterating on the existing gameplay rather than really changing it, wholesale. So, yep. And so, you know, the demo has you, it gives you a pre-made player. It doesn't let you choose anything. And the weird thing about this demo though is I'm playing with the Circle Pad Pro, and for some reason, I always use the ZR button to dash, but for some reason the ZL and ZR buttons aren't even working on mine. So you can, when the game menu pops up and asks you if you want to use the Circle Pad Pro, it says specifically hit ZR if you'd like to activate it, but then you can't use that button in game to dash. So weird. I don't know what the deal is with that, but yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it so far. I beat the first monster, the beginning monster. You know, I mean, I just take the greatsword and beat the hell out of them. So, but yeah, I mean, it's Monster Hunter-y Monster Hunter. Very similar to Monster Hunter 4. You know, you can climb up walls and jump off of them and, you know, mount monsters like that and stab them on the head and stuff. So, yep. But yeah, I mean, the main changes are the hunter arts and the fact that you can play as one of the felines. The different types of attacks. I don't know how they add to that later on in the game or what as you improve your character, but yeah, so it's cool. So, I mean, Monster Hunter fans will be able to pick it up and just, you know, just start running.
So go ahead.
So one thing that's not in the demo, and I can't talk about the Western version, but I can talk about my time with the Japanese version, is the flow of actually getting started with the game and getting into the meat of the game is the best it's ever been and is leaps and bounds above even 4 Ultimate. Mm-hmm. So that's what I like, but that can't be shown in a demo, really. So
yeah, I mean, that's why it's like, that's why with Monster Hunter 4, I was really glad that my save file, actually specifically, it's funny you bring that up, because specifically with Monster Hunter 4, I'm like, thank God I didn't lose that save file, because I do not want to do the ramp up work again at the beginning of the game. It just takes me forever.
Do you know how to use a whetstone?
Yes. Oh God, the whetstone.
Are you sure?
Oh my God, it's like, that's like a side
rant. There's 2 quests.
Yeah, that's a side, yeah, that, but also the fact that they changed the way the whetstones behave in Monster Hunter 4, where, like, it's like, oh, you hit the monster twice? Oh, yeah, you gotta use a whetstone.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
this is getting wonky now.
Yeah, it's getting inside Monster Hunter a little bit.
But, yeah, sorry about that.
That's okay. That's okay. I'm glad John finally has someone who shares his Monster Hunter passions.
Yes.
But delectable. John, I have to ask a question. How did you feel about a game that is how did you feel about playing a demo for a game that is so shamelessly knocking off The Legend of Zelda Into the Wild? Oh, well, shoot. I meant to use a different movie. We've already used that one. Damn it.
Yeah.
Wild Wild West. There we go. Done. Also, is there a giant robot spider? Because I need a giant robot spider.
That is Ken Branagh, for that matter, doing a southern accent, if I remember correctly.
Oh, poorly.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I don't know. I mean, it'll be interesting to see how it compares to Girls Gone Wild.
Professionalism is the word of the day.
Two shots. I was 2 shots. It was a new one.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a big open. Is the phrase open air? Is that what we're calling
it? It's an open air game.
Okay. Yeah.
It's an open air Monster Hunter.
Like, it's actually convertible. It's a convertible game. Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
But Sarin, actually. So what is different about it? What's improved with the beginning of the game? How do they make it easier?
I'm trying to remember complete specifics because I put 80 hours into the Japanese version, but the biggest was that I felt like I was in the core loop within 90 minutes.
Yeah.
in 4 Ultimate, how long would you say that takes? Like 5 to 6 hours?
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
that was praised for scaling it down.
That was the improved version. 3 takes like 20 hours to get into the core loop of the game.
Yep. And really doesn't even, like, you don't gain anything. Like, you don't really learn anything. It's just kind of like repeating the same thing over and over again.
Just you do a whetstone. What do you think it's for?
It's a lot of learning how to cook, learning how to heal, and learning how to use a whetstone constantly. In Generations, I believe a lot of that stuff is introduced, and then they don't touch on it again by force. You can read more information if you would like, but they make a lot of that optional, I believe. Mm-hmm. Which, let me tell you, because core Monster Hunter fans, this will be probably, I would say, the 4th or 5th big one that a lot of Japanese players would play, because there's like Third Strike, 3, 4, 4 Ultimate, and then this. Mm-hmm. I would say that this probably would have been the last chance they would have had to not do that, and I'm glad that they finally just said, look, people who are playing this game, the majority have played other Monster Hunters.
Yeah.
If you haven't, come this way. If you have, there's Zone 4.
Yep. Exactly. Yep. Like, that's how I am. I'm just like, I don't even want to mess with the bullshit. I'm going straight past the kiddie park, and I'll be in the deep end of the pool over there.
Yeah.
Let me teach you how to farm.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Yep.
On that note.
By the way, that was heavily featured in the Monster Hunter 3 demo, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was also heavily featured in 3, because that was one of their new hooks. And they focus on that a lot less in subsequent games, probably due to player feedback.
Yep.
Because it's awful.
Yep. Yeah, I need...
It's not
I mean,
why
when,
people
when,
come to it.
I mean, it's the kind of thing where it's like, you know, when they're making FAQs strictly for that, it's like, do we really... Is this really about monsters anymore, guys? I mean, really.
When game FAQs has multiple documents in its in-depth FAQs for your feature, maybe you should either A, tutorialize it more briefly and better, or B, maybe just tone down the focus on it. Let players ignore it completely.
Yep. Now, Serene, did you play this on an XL?
On a new 3DS XL, yes.
Sweet. And now, obviously, I don't know if you... Did you compare it to the original 3DS?
I did not, but it ran very, very well. It looked very good.
Yeah, because I think it. This game, I mean, I'd be curious to see side by side, because I think this game, I think it chugs just a little bit on the 3DS.
So
maybe
it's better.
Just a demo. It's
so
not
it's better
bad
than Hyrule
at all.
Warriors.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Apparently the patch for that came out today makes the old 3DS version run worse.
All right. Well, that's a dark timeline we're going to need to move on from. So,
yep.
Okay, I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to go into this, because...
There's a reason I'm here.
Yeah, I have Tokyo Mirage Sessions, and I prepared myself for playing this Japanese experience by starting it up on hour 40 of having not slept, so...
Mm-hmm.
I played the prologue without sleep for about 2 days. So that was a good experience to have. This game's weird. So if you've somehow missed our conversations about it, this is the infamous Shin Megami Tensei Fire Emblem crossover that blindsided a lot of people by being a pop idol JRPG about your inner musical spirits.
Performing and mirages.
Yeah, it's a real thing.
So, yeah.
I'm through the first real chapter. So there's a prologue, and then there's a chapter.
The dungeon that was shown last year at E3, you finished?
Okay. The floating maid costume dungeon.
Yes.
Its defining feature is you use a giant mage dress as an elevator. So that pretty well feels like describing what you're in for here. Basically, you play as a group of high school aged aspiring pop celebrities who have inner spirits known as mirages that let them fight other evil intended mirages who are attempting to steal the performer's spirit from people.
Mm-hmm. And well, yes.
And it features like cameos from Fire Emblem characters that have been heavily redrawn by Shin Megami Tensei artists.
Actually, no. They got a professional artist group at Toy 8, T-O-I 8, externally to do all of the character designs for the Fire Emblem characters. And Intelligent Systems apparently gave them all of the instruction.
Oh, God. So Nintendo needs to keep better eyes on that team. Because there's some real nightmares in this game.
You've seen Tharja?
Not yet. I can guess where that's going. I say this because there is this, even knowing going in, even being of the show's normal cast, the best equipped to handle this.
I'm here for a reason.
there's an adjustment period on this game because this game comes at you hard with its Japanese-ness, and not just because the game is still in Japanese, which English, you know, text at the bottom. Most of the time,
85% of the time.
Yeah, like some of it's just not translated. They just didn't care. It's just like, nope, don't worry about it. They're just talking to each other. It's like,
would you have put the subtitles in the battle scene? That UI is maxed out.
I get that, but at some point, like, some of that is actually kind of helpful information. Like, hey, if you use this, I will attack also.
Yeah, or some of the stuff they're saying is they're actually, this is the one thing that isn't getting, shown through other UI, is that they are saying, like, this is a great session, or, like, I'm feeling okay about this session, and that becomes a lot more useful later, because that actually gives you the odds of some of the chance of the attacks that have a random percentage chance of occurring.
Right.
So it can actually say, the odds are in your favor on this one.
Yeah, versus like, hey, don't do that. It's not going to go well. So basically, let's take a step back. So what is this game? So it is, it's its own IP. If I was to try to start boiling it down to what it is a fairly traditional, and that's going to seem pretty crazy, structurally fairly traditional JRPG, at least to this point. There's a certain amount of world exploration that you can do, but it's pretty confined areas. The game is pretty heavily pulling you from point to point.
It's very streamlined.
Yeah.
Have you finished the first intermission?
I beat the boss of the first chapter. Had a story sequence saved. It asked me to save at the end of the chapter. I saved and turned off the Wii U, so I guess not.
So, yeah. All the side quests happen during side quest times.
Okay. That's not out of character for this kind of stuff. So, that falls in that traditional form. But basically, you go story sequence, dungeon, boss, story sequence, end of chapter. Like, it's fairly normal process. In general.
In the first chapter, that's what happens.
Okay. All right, fine. That's what I've seen so far. So there is a sense of like, okay, the structure of this game is fairly straightforward. Where the game actually deviates is how they've sort of mashed together systems from different games. So everything has levels. Like things level up all over the place. After every battle, you watch like 47 sliders go across the screen. The screen explodes in neon light and stars that twinkle as things level up. Characters slide into screen with portraits drawn in a completely different style than anything else.
And then you hear Fire Emblem level up noise.
Right. Then you get random stat boosts that you can totally save game to try to be like, all right, I'm going to get better stats this time when I Fire level Emblem. Up. Yep. And then your Performa, which are totally not Personas guys, level up. And they may gain The Mirages level up.
The Performa is the energy.
That's right. They may gain skills when they level up, or they may not, because they have max levels. And then you have to go fuse stuff.
The Carnage Unity.
Yeah, you have to go fuse things to change their weapon so they can gain more skills. And sometimes they'll get a skill they already have, and you combine it, and that skill goes +1.
So can I explain that real briefly?
The game doesn't do a good job at all of explaining that. It's like, here's some stuff figured out.
Here, I'll give you the 2-sentence version of how you gain skills and manage that in the game. So, So all of the Mirages, which are the Fire Emblem characters that are your allies, during battle actually transform into your weapons. As you get new weapons, each weapon says, as you level this weapon up, here are the four skills that it will teach the character. So, for instance, Bufu, the ice spell, could be on one of the swords. And as you level that sword up, you've learned Bufu. But then once that sword maxes out its level, it's useless until you go get a different sword, which can teach you new abilities. And you can see the abilities that the sword is going to teach you before you make it.
Right. But you have to have things from the enemies to make them. And so sometimes you don't really have... And so sometimes you just don't have the parts to give everybody a new item, and you end up not able to equip anything to anybody. So that's right now in the dungeon, or I finished the second dungeon, the first chapter, and I couldn't replace... I'm blanking on her name right now.
Tsubasa.
Yeah, I couldn't replace her weapon because I couldn't fuse anything, so she didn't really gain anything from that dungeon in terms of skills, which is a bummer. But my choice was to leave and come back, and that, you know. So there's that to it. There's systems on systems on systems going into this game already.
The game does notify you, though, whenever you've collected something that's important, you'll get a text message on the gamepad saying, hey, that sword you might have wanted, you can actually go fuse it right now if you want.
Oh, yes. Your phone is your gamepad. And people text you all the time, like your boss at the talent agency, because you want to be stars, is a drunk.
Absolutely.
She's texting you pictures of drunk animals. And, like, saying things, and you're like, that doesn't seem right. I don't think I want to read your text messages anymore. It's
On the topic of this seemingly crucial gamepad usage, can anyone explain the lack of off-TV play to me?
Yes. Good. The gist of what... The most important thing it has... James, you've probably found this really useful by now. If you haven't, the next dungeon is going to solidify that. Is the omnipresent map and the fact that also in intermissions... let's say you've met Toma, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's... as soon as you join the intermission, here's what's going to happen the second you load up your system. You're going to get a text message from Toma saying, hey, I need help with this request. I've dropped a pin, and you basically tap on the pin, and that adds a pin on the gamepad menu, on map, which will tell you where it is. But... the map and a lot of the level design actually gets complex to the point where a mini map would make the game almost unplayable in some dungeons. So, and this is, I believe, what the design team has said, is they had the mini map and off TV, but that just wasn't a good experience, and so this was the compromise they made. And they could have done a Xenoblade, but also this game had a budget and a release date.
That seems like the more realistic reason is we had a date we had to hit, damn it.
But
in general, I don't use the gamepad that much. But granted, the first dungeon's fairly straightforward. The second dungeon is actually probably more straightforward than the first dungeon, but I'm sure they get somewhat more complicated, but.
There are some of the best dungeons and level designs I've ever seen in an RPG in this game. This is by the level designer behind Radiant Historia, Devil Survivor 2, SMT Strange Journey, SMT 4.
That's kind of cool. Like I'm not just totally bewildered with this game, although there is a certain amount of that going in right now. But, like, this game is aesthetically kind of unbelievable style-wise. There is a certain just like, energy to this game that really comes through and fits thematically with what they're trying to do. It sort of flows between these animated sequences, this heavily cartoonish world, this kind of, like, minimalistic depiction of crowds, which is largely done for... processor, I understand, but like it fits
absolutely.
the character models are detailed in the right ways and not detailed in the right ways, and there's something about this game that just works stylistically. So I'm enjoying it, but like it comes at you hard. Like mm-hmm. It's like this game, we really didn't think about localizing it. We made it. We just said, we'll figure it out.
So how close does it feel to a Japanese Gem in the Holograms RPG?
You know, without the big hair. Yeah, like you could kind of make that draw that line somewhere.
Well, now I'm intrigued.
There you go, John. I've got a lot. How long is this game?
So what difficulty are you playing on?
Hard.
Good. Thank you. I've been recommending that nonstop to everyone.
The game's difficulty sort of makes it clear, like, hey, if you've experienced with RPGs, this is the way to go. Not like, hey, if you want extra challenges, like, no, if you've played a video game before.
Exactly. Hard is the way to play that game your first time, especially because the battle system only shines when your brain is not turned off. But if you do, let's say, all of the side quests and the main campaign in your first run, the game is going to be about 35 hours long.
Okay, so it's fairly short.
It is relatively speaking. Yes, it is relatively short. If you do not do side quests, you can probably do it in about 28 to 29 hours. But side quests are super crucial to what makes that game special. You will see almost no music performances. You will get almost no character understanding or development without them. And just about every side quest you do gives a new attack to your repertoire that lets you rethink the entire battle system.
Okay, so the crucially important content in those.
Absolutely. That is the meat of the game. The main quest moves it along.
Fair enough. So in the interest of moving along this segment, I'm gonna go ahead and wrap up. And I mean, I've got a lot more time with this game, so I'll talk about it some more. I did want to touch on Rhythm Heaven. I'll do it next week. But yeah, anime is happening. So Seren,
yes.
You have a game that's we'll say outside the normal coverage area for the purposes of this podcast.
Yes.
And I'm saying that just as sort of the primer ground for what we're dealing with here. So I'll let you introduce what you have to talk about, and you can sort of set the ground for what we've got here.
Okay.
As you so desire.
Okay. So the first I just want to say, the reason I'm choosing this to talk about is I just ran it by James yesterday saying, like, look, I'm playing Ace Attorney 6. That might be interesting, but I'm not far enough. My thoughts on Zero Time Dilemma are currently available on Nintendo World Report. And the other game I'm really playing is Lego Star Wars. So
tell me about these Lego games.
Well, you break a lot of bricks and then you rebuild them. You collect studs. But professionalism. So a couple months ago, I started playing a Steam game, which has been featured in the Steam sale front page, shockingly to me, called Kindred Spirits on the Roof. And the reason why this game is getting such preamble is because this is actually also the first game that Steam has allowed that contains uncensored pornographic content.
I did say this is untread ground, so...
So it's not it is Honey not... Cam Studio? Forget it.
That has no pornographic content. That is a clicker game.
Aren't we all just clicker games?
So, this game is not a porn game. It is not a sex game. It is a visual novel. It is a visual novel longer than any of the Zero Escape games. It is 30 to 40 hours long.
Oh, Jesus.
It is a long game.
All right, so what is this game?
So, In the game, you play a character named Toomi-san. Her first name is Yuna. And she is in high school. She's really antisocial. She has two friends. One is a neighbor, and one of them is just a classmate that bothered her until she decided to call her her friend. But she eats on the roof every day because she doesn't have to see other people. Very relatable. And turns out to the other people on the roof, she finds out after they start talking about her right to her face, are ghosts that only she can see. And in this world, in this weird world, because they both died at the school, neither of them can leave the school grounds as ghosts. So they've basically been trapped on the roof for one of them for 80 years and one of them for 30 years. And they are in love with each other. They're both women. This game, it only has women characters. And they believe that the only way they can pass on from this mortal plane is to do so without regrets, which means to basically have sex with each other for the first time. So the issue, and this is actually, this game has a lot of cultural commentary on Japan and Japan's views on LGBT culture, is they have no idea what that is or how it works. So basically I don't want to say gunpoint, but basically at we'll curse you for the rest of your life threat, Toomi-san agrees to basically become Cupid between other girls at the school that she doesn't know, because the ghosts, basically the structure for the beginning of the game is they find two girls who are friends, and one of them doesn't know how to confess, basically. And, like, they're withholding their feelings because they feel like it's immoral, they're going to get shot down, they're going to ruin their friendship, or just, you know, you don't do that with another girl. And so you basically go behind the scenes and try and rig the school in some cases so that they're in the exact perfect scenario so that their relationship can progress.
So what's the core gameplay hook here? Like, how do you actually do this?
You click and you click and you click, and it's a visual novel.
Oh, so it's literally just reading.
Yeah, it's a giant ass book.
Okay.
There's some dialogue choices, but
okay.
There's no, like, you're not like rigging. One of the scenes around midway through the game is like there is a student who has a crush on a teacher, but the age gap is only like 3 or 4 years, and the teacher is beloved by all the students, and she's super young and she's really short. She's the only person there who looks like she's 12, and of course she's the teacher. But so they do play that off and say, like, hey, it's a trope, and that doesn't make it better, but whatever. And so she confesses to the teacher, and the teacher's just like, oh, that's probably a misunderstanding, because there's different types of love, and you can love me as a teacher, but, like, women don't love women like that. And the student knows that's BS, and Yuna-san knows that's BS, and the ghosts do. So the ghosts make Yuna-san, Toomi-san, go and, like, make sure that the teacher sees her at specific points in the school where the lighting is such that it's going to be the most flattering to her. And you don't, like, use the mouse to rig the lighting fixture. You make decisions, but, like, there's no real branching paths outside of do you see, like, this bonus scene or not. But the structure of the game is what really interests me, is so you do this, and let's say you go, it's broken out into like a school calendar, a Japanese school calendar, so like April to December, and for the game, because it starts midterm. And so you, let's say you do 2 weeks of the main story. Then once you've cleared that and you've like meddled, for lack of a better word, and things are starting to go smoothly, you can then go and view those 2 weeks from the perspective of all of the other characters you've interacted with so far. So you can play through like what the characters who didn't know they were being meddled with saw, and like how the ghosts are impatient with you for taking 8 months, and like you can learn a lot of the backstory this way. And most of the game is about that character development, and the 18 plus parts are like 30 hours in. So like I said, this isn't that kind of game. But I kind of wanted to talk about it because, one, I initially started playing this for research. Anyone who's played through what I've launched with Monochrono Prologue, minor plug, will know that some of this
you can't say that all in one breath.
some of you will know that this is applicable to the story I'm trying to tell with Monochrono. But on top of that, just like, okay, there's a lot of layers to this of, here's a Japanese visual novel about LGBT romance that doesn't, I don't want to say like dehumanize.
It doesn't use the standard Japanese kind of depiction for it, because Japan is not as, in general, in broadly speaking, painting with a very broad and unfair brush. It is not something that Japanese media generally depicts with a tremendous amount of compassion.
Is it like kind of made into a caricature?
A lot of times in a lot of media, and there is another series that has 17 games in it. It's going for that Neptunia level of release output.
We don't talk about that here.
Sono Hanabira ni Kujikuze wo, which is like,
yeah.
Which is like a kiss for the petals. And that is a dirty pun. And but
professionalism.
But that series treats, that is that kind of game. It's another visual novel series, but that it really is that kind of game. And like, it, if you're trying to like read it because you're interested in the characters or the scenario or anything like that, like it becomes really frustrating because all that game wants to do is how many places can these two girls do it? And in Japanese culture, it's a lot of either that or LGBT doesn't exist in this country, which is patently false, but it's really interesting to see this come from Japan, get localized after like 2.5 years of the localization company, who shall not be named.
Because they make porn games primarily, is the reason. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like really, really raunchy named porn games.
Mm-hmm. But like they fought for like 2.5 years for the rights to this, and then it really took off in Japan and in the West to the point where, one, Steam relaxed its no, you gotta make a censored version, and I do legitimately mean censored in this case, version of the game for Steam, and like you can direct your fans to a fan patch, but like they were just like, no, you can put up the full version. They looked at it, and then they started promoting it, and it did so well for the localization studio that they're localizing all of the drama CDs.
Which is the most Japanese thing in the world.
Absolutely. There are 4 drama CDs. For a visual novel. Yep.
Mm-hmm. God, what are these drama CDs? Explain that concept.
So each one of them is like an hour long, basically radio play, between the voice actresses of the characters in that scene. So the first one is of one. It's a year after the game finishes, and one of your friends from the beginning of the game, is basically being stalked by unwanted suitors, And so they have the terrible idea of, well, what if you pretend that you're going out with someone else to try and, like, throw them off the scent? And so it's basically a one-hour radio play of that.
Okay.
Japan likes their radio plays and their drama CDs. I have an Ace Attorney 6 drama CD that came with the collector's edition of the game. They really love them. But
yeah, it's a weird thing because it takes visual novel and removes both of the words.
Mm-hmm.
It's like inverts them.
But so like localizing all of that, the like 500 something page book in the same universe is also getting localized by a different company. Like, this thing is really picking up in Japan and in the West, and that makes me really happy. Not just because, like, hey, LGBT, and hey, like, I'm a lesbian and I love lesbian things, and da-da-da-da-da, and you people who follow me on Twitter and still follow me on Twitter know that.
I'm glad you know, at least. At least you know.
Oh, I know. I know. But the, like, especially the fact that Valve got behind this game.
Well, and I think more broadly, I assume this comes from a fairly small company in Japan.
Yes.
Because there is that sort of cottage industry of making, a lot of times they are, you know, they're visual novels or they're very, very simple game, simplistically gameplay. There is a recent trend of those somehow getting picked up by also cottage industry publishers in the West for localization.
Usually this one.
Yeah. But more broadly, you have stuff that's maybe not so risque and possibly more stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Things like Hotful Boyfriend, which has no reason for at all. That should have ever been translated out of Japanese. There's no...
That's correct.
There's no justification for this. And yet, it is. And in fact, it got a fairly substantial publishing engagement in the West. And there is sort of this...
I have it on PS4.
Yeah, the fucking Hotful Boyfriend's on PS4.
What a time to be alive.
Where you play the world's only human who lives in a cave and goes to a school full of pigeons and then dates them. That's on the PS4. You're welcome, America.
Yeah,
it is PS4, though. I mean,
it is PS4. You're
it's
right.
Also on Vita.
Well, yeah, of course it's on Vita. That's where it belongs. It belongs on Vita.
It does. It belongs on Vita.
Vita means pigeon sex. Mm-hmm. So, I mean,
That's what they didn't tell you in the press conference.
But to the point, the digital platform of Steam has sort of allowed this cottage industry in the West to develop that allows these games to come over.
Uh-huh.
And seeing them now, it's built up its own fan base where these things are actually able to be successful.
Uh-huh.
Which means we get more of them. And ones like this one that potentially have more, I don't want to use the word risk involved with them, but more hurdles.
Mm-hmm.
Become more worthwhile to pursue than something like Gunhound DX, which is only hurdle is how do we localize this really fucking terrible story?
There's the localization is handled really, really super well. Like I could not have asked for a better localization on this title. And also worth noting is a less explicit game that had roughly the same percentage of it as sex scenes, Mass Effect, had such a huge kerfuffle.
The Fox News segment.
A couple years ago, and like literally no more of this game than that game is devoted to that. It's like a couple 45-second scenes, but the fact that this can come out and be lesbian and be a $40 game on or $35 game on Steam and like all this other stuff and get really, really well received makes me really happy.
Well, I mean, it'll have a small audience, and let's just be honest, there's no money, there's no ad money to be made in covering it on Fox News.
Are you sure?
There probably is.
I don't want to spoil the ending, but there's ghost possession involved.
Thanks, Japan. All right. On that, we're going to take a break and have a really short email segment. Really short. Un petit email. So, we'll be back.
That's some good French. Wow.
And we're back. I'm less surprised at the introduction of this segment. And it's time for a little bit, a listener mail. I'm naming things like the European versions of...
Choto.
Yeah.
And it's Listener Mail Express in North America. That's awesome.
Right. Yeah. You could send your email to RFN at NintendoWorldReport.com, and we'll read it on the show, potentially. We get some emails and some, you know, if you haven't heard it in a while, you sent it a few months ago, go ahead and send it again. The backlog does kind of get hard to manage sometimes, and sometimes things slip. Or if you want to update your email, go ahead and send it again. But, John, read an email to me.
All right.
Any email. Read me any email you want, except for the one from the other James Jones. We're not doing that.
I got some pretty good material in my spam folder, James, but we'll save it for another day. All right, Jacob writes, this week I'm curious to know how you guys feel about possibly paying for online services on the NX. Insert alarm here. I'm thinking about this because my Xbox Live Gold ran out, and I simply don't want to pay $60 for it. It made me think about how nice it is that I don't have to pay for Nintendo Network services, but then I immediately thought back to playing Smash Brothers at a solid 5 frames per second. Obviously, not every match is like this, but I've nearly never had this issue playing any games on Xbox servers. Simply put, are reliable servers worth paying for? And if so, what's a reasonable price? Again, thanks for the great show every week.
Well, I apologize for every week falling through, but, I mean, it depends on the games you're looking for. I mean, if in the case of Xbox, for the kind of games that exist in that ecosystem, like, if it didn't have, you know, dedicated servers for stuff, there's so many online shooters, and not to stereotype, online racing games are a big component of that, of, you know, the exclusives for that system.
Like, it's not like Nintendo can't do what Microsoft is doing.
No. I'm not saying they can't, but I'm saying the games that are synonymous with that system are very online focused.
Yeah, I'm just saying that I wouldn't necessarily assume that just because you're paying $60 for Xbox Live that you're getting something extra for it.
Well, especially because the PC games that are on Xbox Live don't have an Xbox Live subscription.
Exactly. Yeah. So not that that's a huge amount of games necessarily, but yes, point taken.
Yes.
Yeah.
So one side note that I realized, because I didn't write this email, I promise, but my Xbox Live Gold also just ran out a couple weeks ago. And I was like, whatever, I don't use Xbox One for anything. But I got LEGO Star Wars on it, and so I booted it up, and I wanted to take a screenshot. Turns out, sharing screenshots to social media is a gold-only feature on Xbox. They changed that at some point. And, like, Xbox Fitness, may ye rest in peace, was, like, not a game, but if you had Xbox Live Gold, you could use it. And while they've moved away from gating features like Netflix and Hulu and HBO behind the Xbox Live Gold paywall, it's important to note that they're not only... you're paying for servers, but you're also, like, they're also locking other stuff behind and then giving you stuff like Games with Gold. Or in Sony's case, PlayStation Plus with the Instant Game Library. So,
and they're also profit-taking. Like, mm-hmm. Xbox Live is a profit center for Microsoft.
Mm-hmm. but, like, PlayStation has a very wide variety of games, especially PlayStation 4, especially ones that don't rely on online multiplayer. There's a lot of single-player content. And for that, what a lot of players actually subscribe to PS Plus for is the Instant Game Collection. And I would be okay with paying a small fee for online multiplayer on a Nintendo system, but if they didn't have a Games with Gold / Instant Game Collection competitor, they sure as hell could not charge $60 a month or $60 a year for it.
Yeah, and also, like, you got to think that Microsoft and Sony both have third-party support, which Nintendo really doesn't. And so Nintendo is also not really, you know, with a bunch of notable exceptions, like, they're not really online multiplayer focused. Mm-hmm. So they would have to make that subscription worth it by themselves. Like, they're already kind of struggling to make a library of games that that is worth, you know, that is worth, that makes the Wii U worth buying, you know. So to think that they would have to kind of support to sustain this subscription by themselves, like, it's kind of a, I don't think they could do it.
And I think Sony, when they did what they did with the PlayStation Plus, kind of did change the perception around that kind of value, you know. And that
right.
You saw Xbox, then they had to move. They had to start doing stuff like games with gold. So, yeah, you know, I mean, Nintendo probably would have to, you know, it seems like a revenue stream for them in general, not so much in terms of paying for servers, but, you know, some sort of subscription service that would offer perks for the very highly motivated, you know, highly interested Nintendo fans. Seems like it's a source of revenue that they're, you know, that's out there that they're not exploiting yet. I don't know, you know, if they've got any plans in that.
Well, it kind of already seems like they looked at it and rejected it, because their new rewards program came out a few months ago, My Nintendo, and it doesn't feature, like, it's not a subscription. It's kind of a new spin on what they've always done, which is kind of give points for your purchases, and you can buy games with those points. A selection of games, not any games.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. I mean, it's certainly less, you know, useful or sort of less direct than the Digital Deluxe program was for the people who bought the premium Wii U, which, you know, just converted into eShop credit. Whereas now with the gold coins, you know, if for instance, you know, I guess that's kind of as, you know, something of a sort of quasi monetary value, but it's going to be on games that you don't have any kind of say in what you could apply it to. So you don't know when that might be useful.
So, I'm maybe thinking about this in a slight, from a different angle of what would convince you to pay. Because, like, I just quickly ran over to Games with Gold since we've been mentioning it.
Goat Simulator.
Well, no, for July, it's Banner Saga 2, Tumblestone, Rainbow Six Vegas 2, and Tron Evolution. And on top of, you know, getting those four games, which they say are $69 in games, but, like, you get four games every month. You don't get to pick. You don't get to pick them, but they two Xbox One, two 360 games that work on Xbox One, and then you get online in games like Halo and Forza, but also like Call of Duty and Overwatch. And Nintendo's not going to get Call of Duty and Overwatch right now. So, what would convince you to pay a subscription?
And if we're talking in their current environment with the games that they have available to us that we know of, not much, because they don't really have any. I wouldn't say I'm over Splatoon. Like, I've played it a couple times relatively recently, but eh.
Final Splatfest.
Yeah, I don't do Smash that often anymore. I don't do Mario. Like, I could live without my online Smash and Mario Kart. It would be a bummer. I think that would be a mistake. But what they have out there right now on that system, I don't necessarily need a vibrant online community.
Well, that's the thing. But, I mean, they've never historically really pushed online as something vital to their consoles. So therefore, there's never been any gravity behind the online communities on those consoles.
But at the same time, the games that they have coming out for those systems are currently very single player focused. So if they were to try to push a mandatory online fee with what they have right now, it would be comedy.
Yeah, it would be absolute comedy.
Well, I think also just where they've been as well. I mean, you know, I mean, you talked about 5 frames per second Smash Brothers and all that, but I mean, I've played an obscene amount of Smash Brothers, and I know obviously he's recognizing it's not every match that is like that, but I mean, I am consistently impressed with Smash Brothers if you're playing kind of at least you know, kind of either one-on-one or in team play 2-on-2. It's surprisingly good, considering that is a challenging game for lag, and I'm dealing with a wireless connection, probably most people are. You know, it's surprisingly good in that way. And then stuff that's easier to fudge, like a Mario Kart 8 and Splatoon and all that, tends to fare even better. So I don't know whether there's enough margin there really to say, well, we're going to make it, you know, better. So, you know, people are going to be willing to part with their money for that. It would have to be bundled in with other stuff. There's just not, yeah. You know, in and of itself, I don't think anyone would see the value in it.
I mean, at this point, like, your online network behaving properly is expected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and also I would say that you should never be paying $40, over $40 for PS Plus or Xbox Live. You can always find the cards on sale.
Right.
Never pay $60 ever.
Yeah. But like also when it comes to, let's say that tomorrow, July 1st, as we record this, Nintendo unveiled, pay $60 now, we'll give you a free game every month, and then online. Like,
depends on the game.
Yeah, like, okay. So
I would want. What
game do they have that I don't already own?
Exactly. Yeah. What first party are they including? And then what? Because all the independent games that they push, and a lot of people like pick them up.
Right.
And so, like, what do you like? You don't give out. I'm going to throw my own game under the bus. You don't give out. I've got to run a $2 game. For, you know, your subscription service, and you also don't give out 4 games because you'd run out of games way too quick.
Right, you didn't happen to loop back around, and that doesn't really work for them at present. I would say that the only thing I could think of is if they were to come up with premium content, but that feels shitty. That feels like you're buying you know, like the season pass for games that don't have that have the season pass announced with no content in them, like Take-Two games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But like, or 2K, but like worse. Like, because now you're just buying like season passes for lots of games that you may not even own. And don't know what's in them. It's just, it's hard to pin down a scenario where
there is kind of a parallel there with Amiibo. When you buy an Amiibo, you're buying a season pass of
Amiibo
superfluous Mario extras in
Amiibo
various games.
Amiibo are for entertainment purposes only.
Undetermined.
But you do get the collectible.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's a different idea. That's generally why, you know, people have them. But I think it's also important to note that, you know, obviously, Microsoft has been doing this for a good long while, but Microsoft has also been utterly irrelevant in Japan. So this is not something that's been done in Japan in any meaningful way. You know, Sony's basic online, they have PS Plus, but the basic online functionality was there without having to be a member of PS Plus. Obviously, it was there for years before they even started PS Plus. So, you know, even though Sony have gone into subscription fees and all that charging for online, all that kind of stuff, I just, a platform holder in Japan doing that just doesn't seem very likely, given the culture there is a bit different.
And what you get with PS Plus for online play is distinctly only synchronous online gameplay. You, like Mario Maker, if that were on PS4, would not be restricted by PS Plus.
Right.
Smash Brothers would. Level sharing wouldn't. Leaderboards wouldn't. So when you think about that, you think, okay, well then there's 3 games that would be gated off on Wii U currently that anyone would care about. In the large scheme of things, there's Mario Kart 8, Smash Brothers, and Splatoon.
Yeah, I think we're all kind of on the same place. We could probably move on, but right now, we can't come up with a scenario where it makes sense. And
yeah, they
maybe
still have enough games, really, like enough of a backlog of games to really make it valuable in any way. Even if they went the route of like making all the VC games available, most of those, this is not. I don't know.
I mean, if it was Netflix style, maybe, but there's so many third-party licenses involved in their VC that it would be very difficult to pull that off.
They would have to completely restructure VC,
all those contracts.
And you would get, like, the monthly, here are the 3 games that are now added.
And I don't think that's what you'd want. I think if you were going to pay for a subscription, you'd want it Netflix style of, like, this is what we got.
Mm-hmm.
Go and play them.
Netflix didn't have subscription for a while because they needed to build up hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of contracts. But,
right.
Like, Konami would sell you their game on VC, they might not be so receptive to a Netflix-style service.
Right, where they get paid less. But maybe they get paid by more people because more people see the game. Anyway. Next email. GX writes, "Dear Video Game Online Discussion Show podcast hosts." Yep.
And me.
And you. "With the E3 2016 corpse still warm, do you feel Nintendo's shift in presentation was justified and successful based on the place Nintendo is in right now and what we know they have? Was the dominant focus on Zelda's massive differences wise, or should their lineup better have highlighted Monster Hunter, Color Splash, Pokemon, and Change.org presents Not My Metroid? Should the NX7 present in some manner, or was it better to just stick with the software as they did? Could they justify another E3 of this style? And finally, does this year's presentation reflect more strongly in the state of Nintendo or the state of E3 itself? Thanks, and keep up discussing of video games via the internet."
I would say the state of Nintendo, just because Zelda really was the only major card they had to play.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, because you were there.
Yeah, because I was at E3 this year, doing a lot of things. And did they make the right call with what they had? Yes. Were most E3 attendees unhappy? Yes, because guess what? If you weren't at their booth within 3 minutes of the show floor opening, you didn't get to see Nintendo stuff that day. And because the line literally filled up to an 8-hour long line within under 10 minutes, and then they just cut it off for the whole day, including day three.
Their booth had a lot of empty space in it, right? So that was more...
It had like 100 demo stations though, didn't it?
It did, but you could have also taken down like the Moblin statue and fit 25 more there.
Yeah. And it was also a long demo too, wasn't it?
It was a 30-minute experience. And yeah,
so you got like, in there and you weren't coming out, so that's part of the reason.
And there was a presentation as you went in, like they sat you down in a theater and played a trailer for you before you went hands-on. Like their decision to make it a Zelda Disneyland experience worked, but at the expense of getting everyone to see it. And like, do I think it's about Nintendo or E3? Yes, because if Nintendo does E3 next year, and as I left E3, they said to see you next year and posted the dates, and I was like, that's ballsy. But if they show up next year with the recently released new platform and games for it, I do not think they're going to do Zelda again. Or a Zelda, like a one-game style. But it's what they had. You would not have had... like, you could have maybe had 4 Color Splash kiosks in a corner. You could have maybe had 2 tables that had 4 Mario Party stations tethered to it. So you could have 2 Mario Party games going. You could have had the same thing with Federation Force. Change.org's presents Not My Metroid. But, like, as I look at their lineup, and I played Color Splash, and I played some of the other stuff. I just can't talk about some of it.
I think they knew what would dominate conversation by having it out there. And I think they also understood that there was a lot to say about Zelda, and they knew that what they had would be attention-grabbing enough to put them back in the front of the headlines. And it worked.
Well, I referred to Gone with the Wind as Bigfoot at one point. And the reason why I called it that was because it was the one it was the one game where, I mean, and the way I described it was, hey, if somebody said, hey, we found Bigfoot, that would be a big deal. Because no one's ever found Bigfoot, really. Right?
And idiots are looking all the time.
People have been looking for it, and so just the novelty that this is a game in this series is actually people can look at it and it's a real thing. I mean, that in itself is going to dominate headlines. So
right, but like that game. So you know, the E3 stats have come out on, you know, based on coverage and reach and stuff. And that game was the most, got the most front page content on the internet of any game at E3. It was the most talked about via social media. Like, they knew what they had.
It was the most talked about on the floor.
Yeah,
it's, it was their Half-Life 3.
Yeah, everyone was asking me, like, if I showed up, when I showed up to Natsume, Natsume straight up asked me, like, we've been trapped at the booth all day, have you seen Zelda?
Yeah, like people...
Everyone wanted to see Zelda, everyone.
I think what they had is they very smartly realized they had a game that had the potential to do that. And the only thing that would stop it from happening wasn't somebody else. It was Nintendo putting other things in there to muddy the water. And by saying, like, this is what we have, and we are going to fucking go all out. And I think the booth experience was part of that. I think it created this kind of, like, it's this own sort of self-perpetuating hype machine. And putting those things together, having the Zelda game that looks and feels different, combined with them saying, no, it's just Zelda. Like, this is what's here. You want to see video game? You see video game. You want to see something else? Go somewhere else.
Like, well, yeah. Like, and I mean,
I think the ballsiness kind of played into the coverage they got.
Well, in other years, I mean, you know as well as I do that there's been a huge game release that has just overshadowed everything. And it's like, oh, yeah, by the way, we found this kind of cool game buried in their press kit. But because everybody just cares about big game X over here, mm-hmm. there's stuff that's just missed. So this year it's just like, yeah, well, we don't have these those little games, so we'll just give you big game X. There
well,
you go.
They had the Gretzo game, Ever Oasis.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But like, that should have been a big announcement.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
it's like forgotten.
So yeah, like here's the thing, like I don't know. If they had done an E3 2014 style where they replaced Smash Brothers and let's say Splatoon with Zelda, and then just all the other side kiosks were just like, and here's Color Splash. Like, I played the demo of Color Splash, and I actually was one of the harshest people against it, and I actually was sort of won over by that demo. But they know going in, if we show Color Splash, that's going to be divisive, and that's going to get headlines that we don't want it to get when those headlines could be Zelda headlines.
Right.
They know if we put Federation Force out, even a new trailer, well, that's just going to be a vocal minority of people are going to focus on that whole week.
And I mean, that's it, because there is quite a lot of hostility to Color Splash, but that didn't get put in witness protection like Federation Force. I mean, we're finding out stuff now. We have to find out from Japanese trailers.
Because Japan isn't upset about it.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
They don't give a fuck about Metroid.
That's why we have Japan, to find stuff. There's this whole long video I saw, and it showed like stealthy bits and puzzle solving with shooting a ball around and all these kinds of stuff that we haven't heard about before. And that's how you're going to find out about it, apparently.
I'll be honest, the Western reaction to Federation Force is a punchline on Japanese message boards.
But it's because, a punchline on our message boards.
Yeah, but they're just like, what the hell is my Metroid.
Yeah, they're just like, what the hell is going on in the West with this game? Why do they hate it so much? Like, they're just like, come on. Like, it's a game in that universe.
We picked this email because of the punchline. I mean, we are complicit. There was a stretch where I wouldn't let people talk about the game on the show. Like, it's perfect.
That's the thing. If they had a demo there, not of Blast Ball, but of the campaign, which, by the way, might not demo very well because of how it's structured. You do not want, when you have Zelda, and you know you have Zelda, and you know the kind of attention that Zelda is going to get, you do not want Nintendo E3 game headlines about things that you're not confident about that are also, let's say, big. So
I kind of feel like we went over this during our reaction show. Mm-hmm.
A bit, yeah. I think the only thing
the
we
social
can take,
media angle and all that, your crowd, out the messaging and all that stuff.
I think the only thing we can point to now is people have done the statistics work on the back end and gone like, numerically, absolutely, this strategy worked for making sure Zelda was their talking point.
Mm-hmm.
I think the question on NX is, was it just not ready?
And yeah, I could only assume that's the issue there.
People have pointed out, the Xbox One was revealed 6 months before it was released.
Yeah,
and we're 9 months away at least from the NX.
Oh yeah,
so.
I think from a timeline standpoint, it totally could just be that we're going to wait a little bit longer. I mean,
yeah,
hell, hey, this is the new iPhone. It's out tomorrow. I mean, that shit happens now. But
Kimishima-san said during the investors briefing a couple days ago, NX was not at E3 because we did not want people to copy the NX before or around the NX launch.
We've heard that excuse for other things in the past.
We have, and I'm not saying that's their only reason.
Yeah, yeah.
But also, history has kind of proven them right.
Mm-hmm. I would say at the very least, a portion of this was it wasn't ready, or if it wasn't ready, there wasn't stuff ready to show on it.
Mm-hmm.
Besides perhaps Zelda, which I mean. Again, if you were to show a game that wasn't Zelda on NX, you have crowded out Zelda. Because that will take all the oxygen out of there, even if it's just fucking New Super Mario Brothers.
Uh-huh.
And at some point, like, they knew they had a game, they have a game of the year candidate, and they haven't had one in a while. They know they have one. So let's not even mess around with anything else. Here it is. Look at it. Look at our game. And, I mean, more power to them. It seems to have been okay. I would guess they're quite happy with that. It turned out they may uh-huh. have made the Pokemon segment longer just to fuck with us more if they could do it over again. Besides that.
I do have a question for you guys, though, just real quick. What was your what was your experience with, like, social media reaction to Day 2 when they focused less on Zelda and they showed up Tokyo Mirage, Dragon Quest, they had the Pokemon Go Roundtable, Ever Oasis, and...
Social media got a lot quieter, is ultimately what the reaction was.
Okay.
Because I think people take off the first... Like, people take off from work to watch some of this shit.
Mm-hmm.
And, or people, like, dodge out of doing work at their office and kind of watch it on their phone if they have a bad boss who blocks their internet traffic or they watch on their computer. And so... It was just quieter. Ever Oasis caused a little bit of a spike. But a lot of the other games were known quantities. I think on the lead up to Ever Oasis, there was kind of this hum because people were like, well, what are they going to show? Because uh-huh. they'd said it's a new unannounced game. So there's always this kind of like, what's coming?
Yeah.
A couple years ago, we had that because they announced a game at the IGN stream after they did their presentation. And of course, it was Devil's Thirds, at which point we all basically just started crying. But because Ivan was too man for us, but like there wasn't a lot. I think when they went back to Zelda, even then it was still quieter.
Okay.
So it was just a less followed at that point. People were reading impressions and watching video at that point.
Okay. Yeah, because I was just like, I mean, they did talk like they Sega Saturn Rhythm Heaven. They like. And they had, like, a lot of key staff on, like, Dragon Quest VII, and, like, I knew coming out of E3, that was the material I wanted to watch, but mostly because a lot of that stuff and a lot of, like, the insight I wasn't seeing on social media, so I wanted to see what it was.
Yeah, I don't think that stuff got unpacked for a couple days because people had to go back through and kind of go through all the details because they put out so much video. It was hard to really watch it all. So it took a couple days for the stuff that was out there to really hit zeitgeist. So it wasn't like a constant flow of information that keeps social media going. It was like, hey, somebody went through and documented this one interview they did with the person making this game. So now that stuff's kind of been extracted from the video and injected into the internet versus a constant pumping that was happening with Zelda because so many people were watching.
Right. Like, that was just my experience was like on the Wednesday when all that stuff was going down, like I was flipping through Twitter between appointments or in one case during an appointment as they taught me what loot was. And I was just flipping through and I'm like, there are three people here talking about how they're showing Dragon Quest. One of them is Neil. Oh, no, the other one was Neil. And it was just like,
once NintendoWorldReport.com Twitter account.
Yeah.
Being posted on by Neil.
And it was, yeah, it was just like, the stuff I was interested, like, if I watch a Treehouse segment, it's because usually because the developer is there and I want to hear their insight.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't watch that stuff until after the fact. So yeah, I think that's ultimately what it was. People were willing to take time away from their schedules to do day one, but not necessarily day two.
And I think that says everything you need to know about their E3 showing.
There you go.
Yeah, where they had all the other games. Prioritization makes sense, you know, because yes. In some way, so that is really what people are coming for to a large extent. But I mean, I think you could still, you know, obviously next year it could be totally different because of the new system. You know, I don't expect this is a kind of unique intersection of circumstances. I don't expect. Obviously, yeah, there are. You have trends at work, you know, how Nintendo's kind of dialing back from traditional presentations and how E3's going in general, you know, fewer exhibitors, etc. But, I feel like next year will probably be a fair bit more orthodox if things proceed as we expect them to.
At least by Nintendo. I'm not so certain about the rest of the industry, but...
Oh, I wouldn't be willing to hazard a guess.
Yes. Welcome to E3 Santa Monica.
Like, they locked down LACC. But,
God help us.
Yeah, but at least one more year. But, I don't know. Like, there didn't seem to be fewer exhibitors, but the range was certainly different. And, there was walking space at E3, and that should say everything to anyone who's gone to E3.
You mean Yoshinori Ono wasn't standing on a fake motorcycle spinning around chainsaws on a blade on a pole?
No, but I sat down in a quiet hallway so that I could catch my breath, and Kimishima-san walked in front of me.
Nice.
And I asked him what he thought of the show, and he didn't understand that I spoke Japanese.
Perfect.
And that was basically the exchange.
Well, I think we've pretty well answered this one, and I think that's also probably going to do it for us today. So, if you have questions, and after this show, you probably have questions, we probably can't answer them, but you can send them to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Serena, I want to thank you for joining us in my utterly failed attempt to explain Tokyo Mirage Sessions.
You're welcome.
And literally everything else that has happened for the last 2 hours that you have been listening to. So, Monochrono is coming...
Monochrono is coming 2017 to PlayStation 4, PlayStation 3, PlayStation Vita, Xbox One, Wii U, PC, Mac, Linux, and another platform. And Monochrono Prologue is currently available on iOS. Hopefully will be out on Android by the time this podcast goes up, if not immediately after, and there should be Episode 2 coming out really shortly. Also, I have a VR game coming out first half next year. Also, there's one other unannounced project, and there should be a Monochrono development blog update, and also reviews coming soon, and also the Zero Time to Live spoiler cast is up on Nintendo World Report connectivity feed. I'm a busy girl.
All this coming to Ouya in the year of World War 2017.
Fuck.
And on that, Greg, what is our ending music?
Well, you know, just after, the day after this will be posted, presumably, it'll be the 4th of July, where we all, where even those of us who aren't American celebrate Randy Quaid.
Three of us.
Celebrate Randy Quaid giving his life to save humanity. So, we will celebrate this wonderful occasion for everyone in the only sort of honourable, proper way possible with music from Parodius. This is a Battleship Cat Forever from Gokujo Parodius on the Super Famicom. Enjoy, everyone.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Later. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.